This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Every 2 years, the Vermont Department of Health and the Agency of Education team up to survey Vermont middle and high school students about a wide range of behaviors and attitudes that affect health. They look at smoking, drinking, and drug use, physical activity, nutrition and weight, even violence and mental health issues. More than 21,000 high school students and 13,600 middle school students answered questions in the newest survey. It was conducted last year, and the results came out recently. Today on the program, we're going to talk about these results. In many areas, they're positive. Rates of alcohol consumption and cigarette smoking are down, so are obesity rates, and the consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages has declined. But there are areas of significant concern as well, including the high rates of self-reported depression and sadness. And health officials are concerned about the perception of risk around marijuana. The number of students who think marijuana is mostly harmless is on the increase, even if consumption rates aren't. Here to talk about all of this today is Vermont Health Commissioner Dr. Harry Chen. Dr. Chen, thank you so much for joining us.
Jade, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So overall, the big picture, these results are fairly heartening, it sounds like, for the health department.
I'd say yes. I mean, I think to a large extent, we actually tailor our programs, even to some extent our legislative agenda, based on what we see in this extremely important tool about, you know, getting into the mind, so to speak, of virtually all of Vermont's kids in middle school and high school.
So you must look at results of alcohol consumption declining, cigarette smoking declining, sugar-sweetened beverages declining. And we should say these are pretty small declines, and I want to know what the margin of error is, because sometimes they're, you know, 2 or 3 percentage points. But you look at all of that and think that your legislative policies are working. Is that what you sort of glean from that?
Well, I think it's an overall overarching umbrella of policy changes, of public communication, of working with Vermont communities, all of it, which really embodies what public health is. And I think, you know, the important point I would make is, as I said, virtually all kids in Vermont take this. I mean, 98% of schools, 99% of some schools do.
Yeah, we're looking at almost 35,000
kids. 35,000 kids. And the other piece that I think is important for Vermonters to understand is that if you look at what makes us healthy, it's not what happens in the doctor's office. It's our behaviors. And this is really looking at behaviors and at high-risk behaviors and things that we can actually make a difference on, impact by our policies and our programs.
Let's look at some of the areas where the trends are on the decline in a good way, and then we want to spend some specific time talking as well about depression and suicide and some of the risky behaviors or perceived risks that students are telling you about. Let's go over alcohol first. Fewer students drank alcohol in 2015 than in 2013. And remember, this survey was conducted in 2015, but it takes a while to tabulate the results. So what's happening there? How many fewer students are drinking?
Well, I actually don't have the actual numbers for you, but I want to say that it's important to both look at year-to-year survey-to-survey changes, and if we say they're less, they are significant based on the sample. But even on a broader scale, let's look at binge drinking, for example.
Okay.
In 2005, one in four Vermont high schoolers were binge drinking, so 25%. And that was, I mean, to me, that was an incredible challenge. Today, 16%. So, yes, we made progress from 19 to 16%
in the over 2 years.
Over 2 years. But over the long haul, we've made a tremendous difference going, again, as I said, from 25% to 16%.
That is a pretty significant decline. I mean, over 2 years, it was a 3% decline. But you're looking at the trends here, and 25%, I mean, a quarter of high school students binge drinking in the past 30 days is a lot. And I can remember even 7 or 8 years ago, this was still a very alarming number to health professionals and to education professionals. 16% is probably still more than you'd like to see, but that is a pretty significant decline. And do you have specific things that you point to? Is it education? Is it peer pressure actually working on the positive side of things, do you think?
Well, I think, just as an example, we have a Parent Up campaign. And we know that peer pressure is huge in this age group, but we also know that even though parents of teenagers don't think they make a difference, they make a tremendous difference. So just asking your kids about it at the appropriate time, giving, we're actually, as part of this campaign, giving them the scripts that they can use, because it's always uncomfortable, right? But they hear it, they listen to it. We even know that works in college kids. So at UVM, one of the strategies they had was to have a parent email a student right before our big weekend to talk about watching, you know, being careful.
Right, and that would come out from UVM to the parents to say you might want to remind your child to be careful this weekend.
And it works. Yeah. And I think the other piece is sometimes changing the strategy from underage drinking to not dangerous drinking. I know we do that in the college level because it's just the underage drinking piece is sometimes really challenging to message. It's more about your health, right, rather than that it's against the law.
Hmm. So when I was a teenager, my parents always said, you can always blame us. Just say we're jerks and we won't let you drink and you're going to get in so much trouble. Just blame us if you want to. Make us the bad guys to get out of the situation. What kind of scripts do you give parents these days for helping teenagers, I mean kids in high school and middle school, who you know might be having questions or facing peer pressure about drinking?
Well, I think, I mean, it's the conversation really goes like this, that alcohol is bad for our developing brain and can cause challenges further on down the road. And
but a 15-year-old isn't going to say that to his other 15-year-old friend.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you know,
no,
what are you telling kids to say or parents to help their kids
figure I think this
out?
Is more the parent script.
Ah, right? So that's what they should be telling the kids.
Right. And I don't know that I have a 15-year-old script. It's been a long time for me since I was 15.
Well, parents, you can tell us what you talk to your kids about. We'd love to hear how you think about youth risk and youth behavior and how you think about this in your own household. Maybe you have conversations with your kids about marijuana, about alcohol, about depression, and maybe something like this, the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, helps inform you about some of the issues that are going on in Vermont schools and with Vermont young people. If you have a question about one of the areas the survey looks at or you want to share your own observations, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Dr. Chen, we mentioned that over time, alcohol consumption is going down. Can you show through the survey that it's not just transferring to other substances that alter the mind, like marijuana use among young people?
Well, that's actually a really good question. I can actually say that pretty clearly because our marijuana rates have been pretty much the same. They haven't changed since 2005. And so in the setting where we're having decreasing prescription drug misuse, we're having decreasing alcohol use, we're having stable marijuana use.
How does the health department feel about that? Because it's better than seeing marijuana use among young people going up. But it's good to know that people aren't just switching from alcohol to a different substance, but it's also not something that's declining.
I think it's a challenge. There's no question that it's a challenge. And you actually, in your little clip in the beginning, point to one of the greatest challenges is the perception of harm or the perception of disapproval of marijuana is so much lower than for example, tobacco. But I think at the same time, it really points out the potential opportunity because we've managed to create a message in a norming with kids that smoking isn't necessarily cool and it actually is really bad for you. And some of that is not so much that it's illegal, but just pure and simple, that's the message. And we haven't really, to be frank, had the funding or the focus on doing the same with marijuana. And so as we have all of these discussions about legalization, certainly that's something that's really high on my list about if we are going down that road that we need to focus on and understanding that's where we'll potentially get the most bang for the buck.
I have some of the statistics on that perception of risk, the questions that were asked in the survey, and fewer kids these days are actually thinking that alcohol and marijuana is risky to take. So that number is the number of people who say this is risky is going down, which isn't what you'd like to see. 48% of middle school students think kids their age risk great harm from having five or more drinks once or twice each weekend. So half think there is a great risk, presumably half think there's not a great risk. And significantly fewer middle and high school students think someone their age is at great risk of harm from smoking marijuana. Significantly fewer middle school students believe their parents would think it's wrong for them to use marijuana. So there's a perception that parents aren't going to come down on you very hard if you're smoking or using marijuana. And that's something that you would like to see some change in. Do you think that you could get some funding for that, given what the survey is telling you?
I'm hopeful. Absolutely. I think there's opportunity there. And I think it's interesting that as important as that perception of harm is the perception of is there a normal thing to do? And we know that actually there was a survey at UVM where if you asked people how many people smoke marijuana, the kids would say everybody does. The reality is there's probably about 30% of kids that do. But so somehow figuring out how to move that social norm and acceptability has a tremendous effect on whether kids actually will go ahead and do it, whether it's harmful or not.
How do you have this conversation in the context of a legal climate where we're talking about legalizing marijuana consumption for adults?
Well, I think the couple of things I'd mention. One is that looking between 2013 and 2015 is when we actually decriminalized marijuana. And as I've said, we haven't changed that rate. I think that the experience, we could learn a lot from tobacco and learn a lot how we've taken smoking rates in kids from 40% down to 11%. And how do we do that? We did that by counter-marketing. We did that by smoke-free laws. We did that by all the strategies that we use in tobacco we could actually use in regulation, strong regulation, we could use and I believe should use if we go down the legalization route.
So for you, I mean, there are many arguments when we have conversations about legalization where the person who's saying we shouldn't legalize it really come from a point of view of saying this is going to encourage kids to use marijuana and we're going to see consumption rise if we legalize marijuana. It sounds like consumption among young people. It sounds like you don't think that has to be the case.
I don't think it has to be, primarily because they're already using it, right? They're already using it in high numbers in an uncontrolled market sold by you know, who knows what and bought by who knows what. So theoretically, more people smoke marijuana than smoke cigarettes in terms of this age group. So I think, you know, there theoretically, there potentially is a lesson learned there and opportunities to actually make that difference.
Our number, if you have a thought or a question for Dr. Chen, is 1-800-639-2211. Kathleen is calling in from Milton. Hi, Kathleen. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just have a quick comment. I have young kids, a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, and I struggle with this because it's going to happen, and their peer pressure is just so strong these days. But with my 5-year-old daughter, we've been saying things like, the best thing to do is to make a good choice, and a good choice means that you're healthy and confident. And she'll say that exact sentence back to me, and it really does work. Like, she just says things, when I ask her simple things, like if someone's doing something in a parking lot they shouldn't, she says, well, that person's not making a smart choice because their body isn't safe. And so I just hope that we're able to continue with this conversation like that as these things become more and more important, more and more a part of our lives as she gets older.
Kathleen, I love your approach. Thank you for sharing it with us. Dr. Chen, do you talk to parents and gear some of the education to parents starting at ages as young as Kathleen's kids? Because, you know, as she points out, they're already getting messages even when they're 5 and 3, and it's helpful to have some instruction from your parents on healthy choices when you're young and sort of get that indoctrinated in you before you hit middle school and high school and both peer pressure and adolescence hit at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. Whether it be, you know, eating your colors at meal times, whether it be, you know, going out and getting that exercise, and all of those things are really important messages. And Kathleen's absolutely right that to the extent that we can frame them in a positive light, I think that's important both to build that self-confidence but also to build the resilience, which is really key to a lot of the downsides that of behaviors.
But that, I guess, goes right to the question of what's the value of having this survey and how do you use it to shape policy and to shape the kinds of educational initiatives that the health department and the education agency work on. Do you look at this and say, all right, how do we not only curb this behavior in this age group but start at an earlier age?
I think that's the answer. The short answer to that is yes. And so to the extent that we see sugar-sweetened beverages consumption go down in students, we have new guidelines in the federal government in terms of when you can have competitive foods like sugar-sweetened beverages. So they turn off the vending machines in high schools during lunch times. There are nutrition policies that are required in terms of competitive foods through the federal government. So all of these things, I think, determine a lot of what we do. An example was texting. While driving, I think there were 35% of kids went right before they, you know, as one of the impetuses to passing the law to making it even tougher on kids is how many kids were actually texting when they're driving, and that's gone down. So we can kind of see that time and time again where the policy choices and the programs we implement can make a difference.
We're talking with Dr. Harry Chen. He's the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health, and we're looking at youth risk behavior and the results coming out of a survey that's done every 2 years among Vermont middle school and high school students. About 35,000 of them, almost that number, took the test in 2015. And we're looking at some of the results and how they're used. Coming up, we're also going to talk about depression and suicidal thoughts and why almost one in five middle school students say they've seriously considered suicide. If you have a question or an observation from your own home life you'd like to share, or maybe you work in education and think about how you can be influential in these areas or what you think the health department should be doing, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Health Commissioner Dr. Harry Chen about the Youth Risk Behavior Survey that Vermont teens take and health advocates examine. It looks at drug use, depression, rates of teenage pregnancy. It asks young people to share their thoughts on things like the relative risks of cigarettes, marijuana, and alcohol. We've been going through some of the results, and if you have a question or an observation you'd like to share, call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Steve, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Steve. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Sorry, I'm on the sidewalk, so I can't hear that well. But hi, Dr. Chen.
Hi, Steve.
I work in the recovery field in Rutland, Vermont, and I've been kind of obsessing on this question for a while now. And I guess my comment is that I feel like a focus on just the substance, illegal substance use and the behavior is while it's worthwhile, is too narrow. And that when we're talking about prevention, it's really a much wider issue that needs to be addressed. And when we look at numbers for adults turning to prescription medication to deal with various discontents, depression, anxiety, whatever, and we're also using them in schools, legally and prescribed, to deal with behavioral issues in schools, and those numbers just keep going up. What we're modeling for people is to turn to a pill when you're discontented and struggling. And I don't think we're giving kids the tools on the front end to deal with life struggle. And that we're continuing to model drug use, whether it's legal or illegal. And how do you tell a kid not to pick up an opioid when they're 15, when they've been watching their parents use pills for depression and anxiety, and the kids themselves have been giving pills?
Steve, good questions. Let's put it to Dr. Chen. What do you think?
Well, I understand completely, and I think really do agree with what Steve's saying. I think we've created a culture where if you turn on the TV, you're seeing beautiful scenes and great music and some company telling you to ask your doctor about this drug. So absolutely, we've got a lot of work there in terms of creating the concept that wellness is more than just pharmaceuticals, and that wellness may mean, whatever it may mean. It may mean exercise, it may mean eating better, it may mean physical activity or family and community, all those things. And I think that he's absolutely right that in terms of opiates, it can't just be substance by substance. Because as you go upstream, it's about something like a nurse family partnership where a nurse comes and visits every new mother in Vermont to help them navigate that really trying time. And when kids have a high quality child care and daycare, all those things are really important to build that community, that family, and that resilience in that individual child.
Are we doing well, though, with adults? I mean, to Steve's point, it seems like our culture is struggling with these same issues, just generally.
Yes, I think we have challenges. There's no question.
We got a note from Silas who says, how to keep teens from using pot. If a kid gets caught smoking pot, the penalty should be education on the dangers of marijuana and then community service at a cancer ward or better yet at a hospice where they can see that smoking anything causes cancer. Not very pretty. Let's look at cigarettes. Speaking of smoking, Silas talks about the dangers of smoking. And on cigarettes, fewer students are smoking, fewer are exposed to secondhand smoke. A couple of the statistics, 9% of middle school students have ever tried cigarette smoking. That's the same number from 2013. 11% of high school students currently smoke. That's down a little bit. 11% of high school students have ever misused a prescription drug. But on the smoking, you know, Vermont has seen this as a success story. We've seen fewer young people starting to smoke, fewer young people smoking, more young people saying smoking cigarettes is dangerous to our health. So this sounds like an area that you would point to as continued success for Vermont and for their educational outreach on cigarette smoking.
Yes, I would. I'd kind of highlight that there's a lot of a strong evidence base onto what works and how you actually can do it. We actually do spend a lot of money on it because we have from the tobacco settlement dollars. And so there's a clear connection on spending those dollars, having campaigns that might actually focus on a segment of the population, not a general population, and then following that up with social media. Because we know now today a lot of it's about the social media. And then the other thing I'd probably point to on the cigarettes is that even though we made progress on cigarettes, some of the other forms of tobacco and nicotine are challenges. So we know that more kids, high school kids in Vermont, smoke electronic cigarettes than cigarettes. So 15% of Vermont high schoolers are using electronic cigarettes regularly. And that's despite the fact that it's actually illegal to sell it to them. So we haven't done enough. So, and there's a tremendous explosion of advertising. And we know that nicotine is just not a good thing for the adolescent brain, and certainly can lead to smoking. So that's part of why we're very supportive of H-171, which is a bill that works to both put them a little further behind the counter in terms of sales outlets, but also includes them in the Clean Indoor Air Act because, A, they're unregulated and we don't know what's in the vapor. And then, as importantly, it's a social norming phenomena with kids. So if somebody's sitting in the middle of a restaurant lighting up electronic cigarette, that just doesn't, it's hard for a kid to get those two messages.
Right, and the bill would address that by saying anywhere that you can't smoke a cigarette, you also can't smoke an e-cigarette. You can't be using, even if it's vaping, you can't be using it, in the middle of a non-smoking section.
Yes. And then, obviously the untold kind of concern is, well, what happens if they actually go down the legalization route? Who knows what's in that cartridge in terms of vaping.
Our number, if you have a thought or a question on the Youth Risk Behavior Survey for Dr. Harry Chen, is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post comments and carry on the conversation on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Mary Kate is calling in from Colchester. Hi, Mary Kate. You're on.
Hi. This conversation really piqued my interest because I am young enough to have taken this survey every 2 years, and so all through middle school and high school. And I was always curious because we took the test and then never heard anything about it. And even as a student, I was curious as to what came out of it, what the percentages were saying. And I think maybe reflecting that back to the students saying, I know you took this year ago, but here's the results. I think that might really help the students. And then my other comment is that my mom, you were mentioning that UVM students, they were recommending to parents that they send out on email. My mom used to text my brother and I all through college every Friday and say, hope you had a great week, tell me what you're doing this weekend, and I really hope you're safe. And I think it made a huge difference. So I would say it worked for my family, and I would urge other parents to kind of make that connection before the weekend starts with their students as well.
Mary Kate, thanks for your suggestions. Appreciate that. Dr. Chen, how are these survey results, to Mary Kate's first point, how are they then shared with students who took the surveys?
Well, I mean, that's a wonderful point. We've, as we know in our education system, we have a continual challenge because it's all local control. We have been, it's available actually by supervisory union level. It is available to administrators at the school level, but because the numbers can be so small, sometimes it's a challenge in terms of identifying kids. But we've encouraged school boards to use it. We actually have a project where students will take a look at their results in their school and try to get them, to, as Mary-Kate said, to bring them back to the students themselves. But we could do a lot more with that because it's such a robust database.
Can we talk a little bit about the questions surrounding mental health, depression, and suicidal thoughts? 18%, according to the survey, 18% of Vermont middle school students seriously considered suicide, and 20% of middle school students say they were sad or hopeless almost every day for 2 weeks, and that's a number that's increased from the last survey in 2013. When you think about, you know, one in five middle school students saying they've been sad or hopeless almost every day for at least 2 weeks, and 18%, almost one in five, saying they've considered suicide, and I, you know, middle school is a very trying time for many, many young people, but that's an alarming statistic to think about, that many kids who are feeling this level of despair.
Jade, I agree 100%. This is by far and away, these numbers are the most disturbing thing in this survey. And I don't, at the tip of my tongue, have a solution, but it's certainly something that I've already contacted my colleagues over at the Department of Mental Health. We need to figure out a good game plan to try to address this. And to a large extent, I mean, many of the other things in the survey actually can be supportive or actually contradictory to that, which are things like, do my teachers care about me, and does my community care about me, are they subject to bullying? So I think we need to kind of maybe put a package together and look at it and then come up with an action plan, because as you pointed out, this is really, it's disturbing, and it needs some thought and action related to it.
Do you see this as a cultural problem?
Actually, it doesn't really matter if it's a cultural problem, because part of what I have to do and how you public health approaches is, yeah, let's change the culture, right?
Let's go to Bonnie in Morrisville. Hi, Bonnie. Your thoughts today.
Hi, I'm well, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because as a recovering addict, I know that the reason that people abuse drugs and alcohol is not because they don't know the dangers of using drugs and alcohol. It's because we're trying to numb overwhelming emotions. And I'm just wondering, what kind of push is there in the mental health field to not educate kids about the dangers of drugs and alcohol, which they already know, but helping them manage their overwhelming emotions?
Dr. Chen?
Well, there's a Bonnie really points to a tremendous need for better kind of, whether it be overlap or communications between what's happening in our educational system and what's happening in our kind of social service mental health system. If you talk to any high, you know, school administrator, they'll really point to that as one of the major challenges that they face, whether it be behavior or whether it be underlying mental illness. And so she's right. We need to do a lot more work there. I think I also think, though, that education is important, because I can't tell you, as I travel around the state, how many times somebody told me that if only they'd known. I mean, the common perception is a doctor prescribes these pills, you know, pain pills, opiates, they're safe. And so some people, if they had only known that actually they could get addicted from the pills that the doctor prescribed them for their wisdom tooth or for their back surgery. So I think that's it's both. You had to do both. It is a challenge going forward for opiates or for any substance. The same applies to tobacco. The same applies to alcohol.
Let's take a call from Mary in Winchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Jane. It's Mary Gannon from Vermont Partnership and Vermont Vision. I'm interested, and I came in the show a little bit late, so maybe it was mentioned already, but I'm interested to hear about how this data has been disaggregated across race and other social groups. And we've used it before to help us think about when we enter into schools to do work with faculty and students, you know, how some of these issues show up differently across different racial class groups, socioeconomic groups, kids with different kinds of disabilities.
Mary, thanks
and
for
I'll
your...
take my answer off the air.
Yeah, thanks for your question. Dr. Chen, how is this?
So thanks, Mary, for that question. And we've asked ourselves the same thing. And in the past, we've actually done a more comprehensive parsing of the data based on disparities and some of it being income, some of it being minority. And we had a major report done in 2010, and we actually recently decided it's time for an update of that report. So we can do a lot of that, and I think it's important information to get out there because, especially with the items like depression or feeling sad or hopeless, that if we can identify specific either minority groups or different groups, subsets of the population that we can actually focus our efforts on, we're more likely to succeed.
So you will be doing an update of that 2010 report?
Yes.
And do you have a date for that yet?
No, I don't.
And when you look at breaking out the results, you know, you can certainly break out by socioeconomic status, but is it possible to break out by ethnicity? Do we have enough of a sample size to get reliable results?
We were able to in our past, in some of our past surveys. I can't tell you for sure if there's a race question. I presume there is, but it'd be hard for me to commit to that.
Dr. Chen, before we let you go, I do want to ask you about the situation in North Bennington, really shifting gears here. And as many people know, and as VPR and others have been reporting, more and more wells keep coming back testing positive for PFOA. This is the substance that was found at a nearby chemical plant. And I'm just curious about an update from you and how the health department is trying to help residents of North Bennington who now, in many cases, know that their wells are contaminated.
Yeah, Jane, it is a clearly challenging situation, as I think everyone believes that they should have access to safe water. So that really gets at one of the core in terms of our necessities for life. I think, importantly, that we're taking action to both identify where those contaminated wells are. We're fortunate in this case is we have a strategy in terms of treating the water that can actually eliminate any ongoing risk, so that's great. But at the same time, there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty. Because this is a new compound, it's quote-unquote an emerging chemical of concern by the EPA, there's not a lot of data or certainty like you might have with a pertussis outbreak or an exposure to a certain chemical that we have a long history with. So there is a lot of uncertainty, and I understand that we're working with the local providers in Bennington. We're finalizing some arrangements with them to try to get the blood drawn and blood tested for the levels of the PFOA. But importantly, it's really the most job number one is to identify where it is. In a strategic fashion, and two, to make sure they have access to clean water.
That strategy for actually filtering the water or getting the water clear of this contaminant, how quickly can that be deployed?
I think they're going to start like next week. So it's I'm not familiar with the actual technical aspects, but it's basically a carbon filtration system put on the houses.
And just to be clear, you have not seen cancer clusters that are above the averages in North Bennington, but you will still, I assume, be looking at health outcomes for people who are living in the affected areas.
Right. So we've been in contact with the local providers. We've given them updates. We're looking at the literature, which is not great in terms of telling us what effects we might see. You know, the best study actually comes from another unfortunate incident in I think West Virginia with another chemical plant factory, but it's really a study with 70,000 people in it to look for the health effects. And in terms of the things such they've seen, like low birth weight, some thyroid disease, some kidney cancer, and the cancers that we actually looked for as a cluster in Bennington. But there's no question that this is something that people are worried about and disturbed about, and to the extent that I can give them information that will help guide them, I think that's the best I can do based on the science available. And there isn't a lot of science available, to be frank.
Dr. Harry Chen is the Commissioner of Vermont's Department of Health. Thank you for talking about this and about the Youth Risk Behavior Survey.
Great. It's great to be here, Jane, always.
We do have a link up if you have more information that you're looking for from that Youth Risk Behavior Survey. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Coming up, we'll take stock of Bernie Sanders' campaign after defeats in four states last night, and we'll look at where the candidate goes from here. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Why have one Super Tuesday when you can have two or three? Yesterday, several states that have large delegate counts and could swing in the November election held their primaries. On the Republican side, Donald Trump had convincing victories in three states, while John Kasich won his home state of Ohio, and Marco Rubio dropped out of the race. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders supporters didn't get the results they might have wished for. Hillary Clinton won four out of five states, and at midday Wednesday, the fifth state, Missouri, is still too close to call on either side of the race, actually. Political scientist Megan Remmel of Norwich University joins us now to look at what happened and what it might mean for the next stage of the campaign. Hi, Professor Remmel. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, Jane.
In the Democratic race, the five states that voted yesterday were Florida, Illinois, Missouri, Ohio, and North Carolina. Let's start first with Florida and North Carolina. The polls going into Tuesday gave Hillary Clinton a strong lead, and voters actually this time proved those polls accurate. What did you notice about those results?
I think that polling this time around has been pretty challenging, and the polling from the Super Tuesday Part 2, so the Super Tuesday before this one, where we had Hillary Clinton with a 20-point-plus lead in Michigan, and then she ended up losing to Senator Sanders, made everybody think that maybe the same thing was going to happen in these other states, particularly in Ohio. But I think what happened maybe in Michigan is that how we estimated who likely voters were going to be in Michigan was just simply wrong. Michigan, it turns out that we just, as pollers, just didn't do a great job of sampling who was a likely voter. We didn't do a good job of estimating the number of young people who were going to turn out to vote. And so it looks like we actually got kind of back on the horse and did a better job of estimating who these likely voters were in these states where Hillary Clinton was predicted to win and then ended up winning. So I take these more as I take Michigan more as the fluke, where polling is not an exact science, and we did drop the ball. But these other ones have proven that polling tends to be pretty accurate when it's done well.
Got it. All right. And that sort of held for all of the races on the Democratic side this time. Sanders supporters looked at the three Midwestern states, though, with a little bit more optimism, especially given what you were just talking about, that surprise win for Sanders in Michigan.
Yeah.
And they sort of had this idea that the Sanders message against free trade and economic inequality would resonate more in these so-called Rust Belt states. But as we just mentioned, Ohio and Illinois went to Clinton. So does that slow Senator Sanders' campaign momentum?
I think it does to a certain extent. I have a feeling that some of this is the Republican primary starting to bleed into the Democratic primary, especially in something like Ohio, for instance, where they have an open primary, and Illinois also has an open primary. So I think there was a lot of people crossing into other people's parties. So there may have been some voting, in particularly on the Ohio side, of some of these Democrats, particularly ones who have said, well, Hillary Clinton's going to win the nomination. I'm going to go and wander into the Republican jungle and vote for John Kasich because I don't want Donald Trump to be the nominee. So I think voters may start to behave more strategically now, especially on the Democratic side, where if they start to think that Hillary Clinton is going to be the inevitable nominee, that they, especially in these more open primary states, that they jump ship from the Democratic races and jump over into the Republican race in an effort to slow Trump's momentum. Trump, at this rate, needs to win about 60% of the remaining delegates before the convention if he were to win an outright majority. So if you are a Democrat in a state that has an open primary and you don't like the idea of a Donald Trump being the nominee, then it would be strategically in your interest to jump ship and go vote in the Republican primary and maybe cause some pandemonium on the Republican side and have a contested convention. And if you're kind of ambivalent one way or another, or would rather have any Democrat over a Donald Trump.
Do you really think that that could be happening and damaging the numbers for Bernie Sanders? Because it seems to me that people who support Bernie Sanders are often really vehement in their support and are not saying, any Democrat, but, you know, I would support Bernie, but whoever.
I think there's enough of that it's affecting both of their numbers, especially in Illinois and Ohio. I don't think you've got the same level of especially in Ohio, the economic frustration that you saw in Michigan necessarily. And in Illinois, I don't think there was necessarily enough speaking to the Illinois state issues from either candidate, but especially from the Sanders campaign, I don't think there was a discussion of just how dire Illinois itself has a severe, it's probably in the worst state financially of all 50 states. And I'm not entirely sure how much speaking about the national budget picture and international trade was speaking to the fact that Illinois as a state has gone for probably 8+ months without a state budget. So I'm not entirely sure how much speaking to these national issues was necessarily speaking to that particular segment of the electorate.
Now, I mentioned that Missouri is still locked in a tie, and actually, no matter who ends up edging out a win in that state, on the Democratic side, both candidates will essentially split the state's delegates, and of course, the delegate count is what determines the nominee, so let's look at where that stands, and let's actually put aside the superdelegates and look just at pledged delegates, so these are the ones that go along with what the people are saying. In pledged delegates, Clinton is now at 1,561. Bernie Sanders is at 800. The number needed to win the Democratic nomination is 2,383. So, Professor Remmel, although it enrages Sanders supporters to hear it, the math doesn't look good for their candidate, does it?
It does not, no.
You're going to leave it there?
No. I think you're alluding to both the idea that not only is Hillary Clinton winning substantially by pledged delegates, but if you add the superdelegates on top of that, that she would really be in the lead.
Yeah. And so, you know, when Bernie Sanders says we have a plan, when his campaign says we have a plan, they argue that it's actually the next group of states to come down the pike that are going to be in their favor. These are smaller states that often caucus instead of holding primaries. So, you know, it does seem less and less probable. But technically, is it still possible for Sanders to find a path to the nomination?
It is theoretically possible. It would be much more probable if the Democrats held their races like the Republicans now are with winner take all. But the fact that the Democratic races, even in these caucus states where the voters are going to be even more liberal, where the Sanders campaign has typically done better when you look at a race like Iowa, when you look at races like the Minnesota caucuses, the fact that these are not winner take all races means that Hillary Clinton is still going to amass more delegates out of these states. If these caucuses were held like the Republican Party is doing and now is in winner-take-all situations, then yes, he would get all of the delegates out of those caucuses, and those would add up really quickly, and Hillary Clinton would get zero out of those states. But that's not how the Democratic Party works. The Democratic Party is proportional throughout the entirety of its races. So I know a lot of the Sanders campaign and a lot of Sanders supporters are very upset about superdelegates, and they say that that's undemocratic. But if you think about what's happening on the Republican side, if they had superdelegates, you wouldn't be having this kind of this melee between the establishment and the non-establishment. We would have a much more orderly process. You wouldn't have this insurgent candidacy in the Trump, because superdelegates could kind of rein in some of this fervor. So the superdelegates are seen on the Democratic side right now as being, quote-unquote, undemocratic, but the proportional allocation of the pledged delegates is very democratic. So the fact that it is proportional allocation of those delegates means that Hillary Clinton, despite the fact that she may not actually win a majority of the delegates in these states, means she's going to continue to add to that lead even if she doesn't win a majority. And she comes out of Illinois and Missouri, even if she doesn't, quote-unquote, win Missouri, she's still going to get the virtually same number of delegates that Bernie Sanders got.
Well, looking at Clinton and looking at the chances then, you know, a lot of the states that Clinton had been winning were states that are probably going to go to the Republican in the general election in the fall. But yesterday she did win two swing states, Ohio and Florida. Do you think that the voter turnout and her victories there say anything about the potential for those states to go Democratic in the fall or swing to the Republican side?
For the most part, she seems to have gotten an equal number of votes to Donald Trump. And I think if Donald Trump did become the nominee, depending on how the general election electorate responds, it could mean that states that typically are seen as purple or states that are seen as kind of light pink and kind of slightly leaning in the Republican direction might go Democratic. So just because she's winning states that are typically seen as quote-unquote strongholds for Republicans in the general election, given the fact that the Republican side is so fraught with turmoil right now, I genuinely believe that she's got a chance to flip some of these states depending on who the Republicans end up with as their general election nominee.
Well, for that, we'll just have to wait and see. Megan Remmel is a professor of political science at Norwich University. Thank you so much for your insight.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's show. Sugar houses around the state have been on full boil lately, so tomorrow we're going to look at the economics of maple syrup in Vermont. It's an industry that has more than doubled over the past two decades, but it still faces several threats. We'll look at the opportunities and the challenges of the maple business, and you can send your questions or your experiences to vermontedition@vpr.net, and then be sure to tune in tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. Big correction here. Liam Connors directed the show. I'm looking right at him. He doesn't look anything like Mary Williams, but they are both beautiful. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.